I'm just going to go ahead and admit this morning that I can't see any of you.
So those of you who have trouble staying awake, you're off the hook this morning. Just a little bit of eye problems. These frames actually go back from before Katie and I got married, so that tells you how old these glasses are. But we'll make them work, and I think I can see my Bible, so I think we'll be all right. World War II was the bloodiest recorded war in human history. Estimated somewhere between 60 and 85 million deaths in under 10 years, if you include various battles and engagements that led into World War II. That's where the 10-year period comes from. Likely began, or it was the seeds of it at least, when Japan invaded China in 1937. So a little bit earlier than maybe sometimes we think, typically thinking maybe 1939 when Germany goes into Poland. But it is a very bloody time with a lot of killing in world history. Japan and Germany, they continued their aggression. This was not like World War I, where they got in trenches and stayed there a long time. Within 9 months, they had conquered a great amount of territory. And the world was a very scary and confusing place. As these two nations began conquering most of everything that was around them, and it looked like really nothing was going to stop them. It seems they really just made a couple critical errors, or else things could have been very, very different in the world today. In 1941, Japan and Germany both made decisions that probably overextended themselves. Germany pushing through Poland into Russia and engaging Russia instead of keeping their peace treaty that Ribbentrop had made with them, which then brought Russia against them. And then not too much longer after that, in December, as we're well aware, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and a number of other sites, which incited the U.S. to then join the war, and the rest is really history. But up to this point, the Axis was dominant, and they were conquering. And it seemed like there really wasn't a whole lot that anyone could do to stop them. And people were likely wondering why this is happening, and what the world was going to look like if Japan and Germany and Italy dominated the world. And the reality is the kingdoms of men are terrifying. And in our recent history, Nazi Germany gives us this perspective in a way that's really impossible when we look back even to Scripture, into times, into kingdoms that we are for the most part unfamiliar with, except through the pages of Scripture. I want to read Daniel 7 this morning, and I want us to think about this, but I want that scene, especially some of you who lived through some of this. My grandfather served in World War II. He got in at the very end, but he's still alive. He is 94 years old, and this is something that's in our lifetime, that is recent. This bloody death of war that encompassed the whole world. But it is interesting to me that Scripture has something to say about the rise and the fall of the kingdoms of men. It has something to say that I think is beneficial and helpful to all of us even today, even though Daniel's writing about times that are very different. He's writing about kingdoms that existed long ago that we've never experienced, that we've never seen. What he has to say about the rise and the fall of these kingdoms is extremely beneficial as we think about our time, the kingdoms that we see around us, the nations that we see ruling around us, and our interaction with them and the way that we think about them. Begin reading with me in Daniel chapter 7 in verse 1. And we're going to read this entire text. I want you to stay with me. If you need to close your eyes and imagine the scene, that may work for you as well. This is apocalyptic literature. It uses what's called ekphrasis. It's trying to bring out images in your mind and make you imagine what's happening here. And so you'll get a feel for that as we read this text. And so you can follow along in your Bible if you like, or you can just listen, and you can even close your eyes. Remember, I can't see. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them one horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed. And the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued, and it came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words of that horn that was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horns that came up before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, "As for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms. And it shall devour the whole earth, and trample it down, and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and he shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and a half time. But the court shall sit in judgment and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." Daniel is afraid. When he sees the vision of what these kingdoms look like, his color changes, it says. It's like Belshazzar in chapter 5, when he sees the writing on the wall, the same terminology is used, his color changes, he's fearful, his knees are knocking together. Daniel is anxious and he's alarmed. He sees what's happening here, he sees this picture of the kingdoms of men, and he realizes what is going on. And one thing we need to understand as we look at Daniel is it's written in a certain way to parallel some things that have happened already. And you are likely familiar with Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. And I'm just showing you here the overall structure of how this works from chapter 2 to chapter 7. And there's some interesting things about this. For instance, chapter 7 through 12 is a very different type of writing than 1 through 6. But there's a few things that kind of connect 7 all the way back to chapter 1. For instance, it is written in Aramaic from chapter 2 all the way through the end of chapter 7. And you don't need to know all the details about this, but sometimes critical scholars especially try to divide 7 from 1 through 6. But there's really just no evidence that that ever happened. In fact, there's so much evidence they're joined. The Aramaic that joins them in language, and then it changes in chapter 8. And then the structure I'm showing you here, which clearly indicates that the author is trying to parallel some things that happened earlier with what's happening now. For those of you who are maybe more visually oriented, this may help you. This is a visual of how all of this is working. Now, you can see even before Babylon, this is going back to other world powers like Assyria and Egypt. But when you get to the vision of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, you will remember the statue and how it breaks down. The metals decline in value, but they increase in strength. This is a very common sort of thing that happened in antiquity, Hesiod's work and days. Hesiod is in the time of Homer, the 8th century B.C. Some of the first recorded writing that we know of comes from Homer and Hesiod. So that's who Hesiod is. But in his works and days, he uses a very similar type model, which I believe he actually includes the Assyrians, so it's not exact. But Daniel is using something very similar to what was done in the 8th century, talking about the progression of kingdoms and how they'll work. And so he does that here as we're translating this, he's interpreting this dream of Nebuchadnezzar. He's seeing this in a very similar way, that this kingdom with this gold head, that is Babylon, and the power and the might, even a sense of divinity, I think, is given in chapter 7. And then you work your way down, the Medo-Persians and the Greeks, and then what we often think of as Rome, although I think it's actually more vague and more open-ended than that, very possibly. What we just read in Daniel chapter 7 parallels that very nicely. You have, again, these four kingdoms. And these four kingdoms, they're coming out of the sea, and the sea represents chaos and destruction. It is uncontrollable. It is mysterious. They don't understand how the storms whip up and how they come suddenly, and they certainly can't control what's happening in the sea. And so it's seen in that sort of way, and as we've talked about even recently, it's connected to old Canaanite myths of the origin of the world, that there's chaos and it is at war with order. And so this all fits into a dynamic that in the ancient Near East they would have very much understood, that these beasts are coming up and they represent destruction and chaos. And along with that, they are beasts. These kingdoms are represented in a vicious, horrifying sort of way. And it is very purposely done this way. We didn't read chapter 8, but if you were to go into chapter 8, those two middle kingdoms are represented again as beasts. And they give us a lot of information about what we're seeing here. It's specifically mentioned that this is the Medes and the Persians in the second kingdom, and that it is Greece that comes and destroys them. That is explicitly stated in chapter 8. And so we're given a little bit of insight into what is being talked about in some of these texts in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. And so this is something that's being revisited here in the book of Daniel. Daniel, as he's revealing the will of God and his understanding of the kingdoms of men, he's showing, I think, the connection between what's happening with Nebuchadnezzar and his understanding of the world and now what he's seeing in his own visions. And what he's seeing in his own visions, and I want us to understand this very clearly, is this very beastly concept of world history. It is a terrifying and chaotic vision of what the kingdoms of men are actually like. They're hideous. And as we're looking at these various beasts, we start with this lion that has these wings, these eagle wings, and eagles are typically thought of as divine type of creatures. In fact, if you happen across some iconography in the Greco-Roman time, you'll often see maybe an eagle flying, and that has to do with apotheosis. It's the ascension of a Caesar to divinity. The eagle is connected to Zeus. It is one of his images, as is the lightning bolt. And so this is a very common sort of idea, and Zeus goes way back into Indo-European times, well before the time of the Roman Empire that we often talked about. So this is something they would be very familiar with in their day and their time with these images. They also just represent power. Man, you look at any throne of any kingdom in antiquity, and it's going to have beasts that are kind of like this. You know, lions. You walk around the city of Rome, and you'll just see lions as part of the rubble that's laying there. There's a message that's being sent in these kingdoms as they circle their thrones with these strong and mighty beasts. They're not always horrific like this, but they're meant to be strong and mighty to convey a certain message and ideology about what this kingdom is. But here in Daniel's vision, they are horrific. It is this lion with eagle's wings. It's pictured almost in a divine sort of way, but then he sees the wings plucked off, and the lion is forced to stand up like a man and is given a mind of a man, not quite as strong or mighty maybe as he imagines. This picture of Babylon and the way they would have viewed themselves, maybe not quite as divine in their nature, thinking that they are God, that Nebuchadnezzar reigns as God. He found out that was certainly not the case in his interactions with Daniel and with his friends. And then the Medes and the Persians are pictured in this horrific scene of a bear, the coming out of the water, who has these three ribs in his mouth. And not just that, but it says to arise and to devour much flesh. And these apocalyptic type of scenes, often they're picturing things that would terrify someone. You imagine, we're very protected in our society, in our culture. If there's ever some place that you enter that's going to have wildlife, it's telling you all over the place that it's there and warning you about it. And most likely, most places in our country, you're not going to suddenly have to have a bear attack, or certainly not a lion attack you. We're not worried about those kinds of things. But in their time, they would have been concerned about wild beasts. In fact, it's one of the warnings that's given to Israel if they broke the covenant, that wild beasts would be sent in and destroy them. That's part of what happens when they break the covenant. That's why it shows up in places like Ezekiel, and even in some of the terminology in Revelation, as it's picturing what destruction looks like and what judgment looks like. And so these beasts are horrific and they're terrifying. They are devouring, because that's what kingdoms of men do. And then you have this third king, this leopard that has four heads and four wings. And of course, it's the four winds that stir up the great sea. And so that idea, the symbolism there, is really that it's like the compass. It's extending from all sides. Or in the case of this leopard, it's fast and it's furious, and it's going in all directions. And so we can begin to connect the dots pretty simply here. This great one's going to arise and is going to have dominion and is going to conquer quickly. Who is that but Alexander the Great, as we find in chapter 8, as it goes in greater detail on the Medes and Persians and on the kingdom of Greece out of Macedon. But what's most puzzling here is this fourth kingdom, which typically, depending on which direction you go with this, I'm presenting here, for the most part, the traditional view. There's also some who would say the Medes and Persians are split up, although I think if you read Daniel, they're never split up. So to me, that says a whole lot. But the typical view is that this is Rome. And I will say that I think it's a little bit like maybe the servant of Isaiah, if you'll follow with me here for just a second. I think Rome certainly fits some things about this fourth kingdom, but I think possibly it's meant for much more than that. This is apocalyptic, after all, and I think it's more open-ended, and it is meant to be reinterpreted throughout generations with these kingdoms of men that are mighty and ferocious that go against the will of God. Just like the servant of Isaiah is filled in various ways with Hezekiah, other great men, but the ultimate fulfillment is Jesus himself. I think that's what's happening here with this fourth kingdom that's different. And so follow me here with this, the interpretation part. We're going to get to some of the practicality here in just a minute of what this means for us. But I want us to understand that the kingdoms of men are horrid. They are vile and they are vicious. And that's exactly what Daniel means to project and to portray through this vision that he's recording, that he's seen with his own eyes. This is what he's seeing. He's seeing kingdoms that destroy, that devour. He's seeing this fourth kingdom, this kind of apocalyptic end times type of kingdom that is even greater and more terrifying. It is exceedingly strong. You think about that for just a moment. He's seeing these visions, which are likely Babylon and the Medes and the Persians and Greece. And yet this fourth kingdom, this fourth beast that he's seeing, it's even greater than all of those. It is just exceedingly strong and terrifying. And it's got these teeth of iron. and the claws of bronze. And all of this is meant to show that it's going to take everything that's happened before with those three beasts before it, and it's just going to extend it even more with its power and its might. It devours the whole earth. It speaks words against the Most High, blasphemy against God. It wears out the saints of the Most High. It is so powerful that it's going to think to change the times and the law. This is not a beast to be messed with. That's the simple message. I love the structure of Daniel 7, and I do want us to note that it stops here and discusses another perspective. But I want us to finish before we get to that in the middle of the chapter. I want us to finish talking about what this fourth beast is like. Because he makes note numerous times about the terror that it strikes in his visions. The dominance that it has. And don't get caught up with all the horns and the kings and all that sort of stuff. There are likely various ways to interpret that. And people will try to interpret a lot of different ways. Maybe it's Antiochus and Epiphanes the Fourth, or maybe this is some Roman ruler that's putting down other kings to then rise to power. And it could be either, or it could be both. That's the complication of this, and this is the way sometimes that apocalyptic literature works. It actually could be reinterpreted to fit different times in different situations, but the whole point of all of it is that the kingdoms of men are horrifying. They are chaotic. They bring disaster. And it seems like nothing is going to stand in its way. You need to go to chapter 8, and actually, that's the portrayal that's given of the Medes and the Persians before Greece, this flying goat that just goes across, not even touching the ground, completely destroys them. They're undefeatable. They're great. They're powerful. They're mighty. There's nothing anyone can do, and then Greece shows up and destroys them, and now they become exceedingly great. That's the nature of human kingdoms. They are loud, and they are boastful, and they are arrogant. They speak great things. They boast great words, and now even against the Most High here in this fourth great kingdom, this horrifying beast. It ends here in verse 25, the last picture before it changes the nature of the text, talking about the blasphemy of God, that he's speaking words against the Most High. He's wearing out the saints of the Most High. And he's changing the times and the law. And they're all given into his hand. A horrifying scene. That as people look, it looks like the whole world is being given over to this horrible fourth beast. But this is where the scene changes. And you go from this horrible, chaotic situation, these beasts arising out of the water, to quite a different scene. In the text itself, the way it's structured, I think it actually is meant to convey this. You have this picture of the horrible beast speaking great things in verse 8. And then there's almost a pause here in the vision. And he says, as I look, thrones were in place. And the Ancient of Days took his seat. It's interesting that as we're looking at these kingdoms of men and thinking about this, as Daniel's revealing the history of humanity and these kingdoms that will arise and that will fall and all the destruction that's going to take place with them and the chaos that's going to ensue because of what they're doing. Now when he shifts the scene to heaven, it's very serene. It's very calm. And so Daniel's vision on one hand exposes the horrific history of human kingdoms, but on the other hand, it reveals the order and the sanity of heaven. It's everything earth isn't. And while earth is in chaos and everything looks like destruction and death, in heaven, the Ancient of Days takes out thrones and calmly sits down. He's not running about. He's not alarmed or anxious as Daniel is as he's thinking about what's happening in this vision. Sanity replaces chaos, and righteous fury replaces injustice and evil. Majesty replaces beastliness and hideousness. And that's revealed in the text as you begin reading. this Ancient of Days, he takes his seat. He's calm. He's controlled. He's sane. His clothing was white as snow. It's pure. He's dignified. He has this hair on his head that is pure like wool. He is wise. He understands what he needs to do. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. His chariot throne conveys one of a commander of sorts. The Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies. He's not shaken by what's happening here with these beasts. And this is what I meant by the structure here of what we're getting to. He's surrounded by thousands, thousands, and ten thousands, ten thousands. The people are all about him. They're honoring him. It is a sense of majesty and glory that is not conveyed in these kingdoms of men. And notice what happens. This great beast that is exceedingly strong, that is terrifying beyond everything that can be imagined from those three previous kingdoms. Daniel says, I looked, and I heard the sound of the great words of the horn that was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed. Simple as that. Now, he's going to say some more things about the beast following this. And that's why I wanted to talk further about it earlier. But I do want you to see the way Daniel structures this in the text, because there's a reason for it. Now, as we look at the horrific kingdoms of men and the horrible things that they do and all the evils that we see around us, and we think they are so strong and so mighty, who can stand in their way? This fourth beast that is beyond everything that could be imagined, even from the previous three beasts. The Ancient of Days takes his seat and kills him. And it's over. That's the nature of God. He is not shaken. He is not concerned. He is not alarmed. He speaks and it happens. We've seen that in creation, haven't we? That's part of the point of that account in Genesis 1 and 2, that the Lord says it and it happens. There's no difficulty. This exceedingly terrifying beast that is speaking great and boastful words, that is going all throughout the world, dominating and conquering and wearing out the saints, the Lord arises and judges. He is killed. And it says its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. He is utterly killed and destroyed, decimated. Then he sees in this night vision, one with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man who came to the Ancient of Days, and he is given dominion and glory and a kingdom. And everybody's going to serve him. And it's going to be an everlasting dominion. And it's a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Remember that image in Daniel 2, that stone is carved out without human hands, and it comes and it destroys the statue and it crumbles to pieces. This is what's happening here. This Son of Man is going to come. And although it looks like the world and the kingdoms of men are dominant and powerful and mighty, there's going to be this Son of Man who's going to come and who's going to destroy and bring to rubble everything that seems so powerful and mighty in the eyes of everyone in the world. Now, there's a few New Testament texts we need to think about in connection to this. Really one that illustrates it and one that's reinterpreting something similar into a later time. In Matthew chapter 26, I want you to consider this situation where Jesus is here on trial. He's before Caiaphas and the high priest, and they are trying to force out of him that he is the Son of God. They want to indict him, and they're trying to get him to say he's the Son of God, that he is God, so they can falsely accuse him. And they are in control. They have the power, and in fact, they will ultimately kill Jesus, as we know. But this is what Jesus has to say in response to them. They're saying, tell us you're the Son of God. He said, you have said so, but I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Here's what he's conveying to them. You think you have power, and you think you're in control. But I have power, and I'm in control. You think you can decide how things are going to work and what's going to happen, but from now on you're going to see the Son of Man coming with power. you're going to see this figure from Daniel 7 that we just read about, that the Ancient of Days is placing over a throne, is going to have all dominion and all power and all glory, and all people will fall before him and serve him and worship him. And so in a very biblical sense, this is Jesus smacking them in the face and mocking them, saying, you think you have control of what's happening here, but I have control. And what's happening even in this very moment is the kingdom is going to be given over to me. Another New Testament text is in Revelation chapter 13. And sometimes we imagine that Revelation or some of these other texts like Matthew 24 are somehow interpretations of Daniel. I don't really think that's the case. I think they're just using very similar language for a similar purpose. But what you find here is in chapter 13 and verse 1, it says, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea." That should sound familiar. "With 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth." All this sound a little bit familiar as we read this? He's taking kind of stock imagery and stock language and now reinterpreting it to the time of the saints that he's speaking to here in the book of Revelation. "It opens its mouth," this is verse 6, "and utters blasphemy against God, blaspheming his name, his dwelling," that is those who dwell in heaven. "Also, it is allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all the people of the earth worship him." They think, oh, this beast, this is where it's at. This is who we need to worship. He decides who can buy and who can sell, and he seems to have all of this control. But by the end of the story in Revelation, Babylon is fallen. And it is a destructive mess because the kingdom of God comes in glory and brings judgment on the horrific kingdoms of men. And although it seemed like, even to the saints, that the world was winning and that the world had power and that these kingdoms of men truly had control, the reality is the perspective from heaven is calm and controlled, and he's waiting there. He has books opened, ready to judge. And so the perspective of what we see in our world is often not what is actually reality. We can see this so well in the past. We're really good about that. In the present, it's really hard. And knowing what we know from Daniel, it's not that it's going to be made easy just because we know the truth. Daniel is told the truth, but he's still anxious and alarmed. And so when we look at our world and we see the problems and the evil and we see the chaotic mess of the kingdoms of men, we're still going to be anxious at times. We're still going to be worried. But the message of Daniel can be helpful to us because what it presents is a message of hope, even in the midst of what seems to be a horrific situation. But here's what I want us to understand about this, and that is that superpowers are not safe. They seem safe. They look like everything is great. But you remember what's happening here in Daniel 7 and in Daniel 8, that these super mega power nations and kingdoms, they appear to have everything going for them, but then in a moment it all crumbles. The Medes and the Persians seem so strong and mighty, and then for God's times and God's purposes, or for whatever it is he was trying to accomplish, Greece comes and destroys them. They're not so safe. This is Trajan's temple in Pergamum, one of the 7 cities of Roman Asia, actually, that's written to in Revelation. And in this temple, I'm not getting emotional about the 4 kingdoms of men here. Just have to wipe my face. We have this iconography that's present. It's not just here, it's also in coins in this period. Where Trajan, in front of this temple, is a massive structure and his foot is on a globe. Yes, they understood the world was round, even then. His foot is on a globe representing world domination. But I hope you can appreciate the irony of the picture you're looking at, which is the only thing that's left is a little piece of that foot with the globe sitting on it. Nothing left. It's in ruins. And this man and all the others before him who thought they were dominating the world, which I think is what the fourth beast is all about, these nations that would come and go, who are terrifying, who are strong, who do seem like they are dominating the whole world, and they are scary, ultimately they are cast down, just like all the others. And so they are not safe. They are not what they portray themselves to be. they don't give us the peace of mind that they would like to think they can give us. And the only true peace of mind and comfort is going to come from being in the kingdom of the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. In our day, I think it may be better represented in where we started, and that is in the seeds of World War II and then the ultimate end. The Nuremberg trials, 24 men were indicted and put on trial. Most of them were leaders in Nazi Germany. Some of them were bankers and others who had some connection to what was happening. But the 14 who were executed were all, to some degree, high-ranking Nazi officers. And I like what Dale Davis has to say. Dale Davis wrote a book covering Daniel. I highly suggest it, and some of the stuff we've looked at even this morning comes or is inspired by some of what he wrote. But he has this to say about this situation. Their bodies, after they were executed, were brought to Munich, and they were cremated, these 14 men. He says, that same evening, a container holding the amassed ashes was driven through the rain into the Bavarian countryside. After an hour's drive, the vehicle stopped and the ashes were poured into a muddy ditch. 5 or 6 years before, these men could dominate and intimidate. That night, a drizzle washed them away. That's the kingdoms of men, ladies and gentlemen. That's what Daniel's talking about. That what we see around us, it seems so powerful and so mighty and so strong and so controlling. But the reality is, in a night, it can be washed away in a drizzle and be worth absolutely nothing. And so before we put our hope and our trust and our confidence in the kingdom of man, like much of the world does, as Revelation reveals to us, we better think carefully about what Daniel's telling us in Daniel 7. That these beastly and horrific kingdoms of men that seem to have all the power and all the control in a moment are going to be cast down. And the Ancient of Days is going to sit on his throne. He's going to open the book and he's going to cast judgment. And with a word, they will be killed and removed. And the true power and the true majesty and the true control is with the one who is sitting in heaven, with the Son of Man in his right hand. That's the picture in Psalm 2. If you're familiar with that psalm, he laughs, right? He laughs in heaven. All the things that the kingdoms of men are trying to do against him, he just sits and laughs at them. Because he knows they're all going to come to nothing. And so the message for us is we need to be in the kingdom of the Son of Man. We need to be in the kingdom of the Ancient of Days and realize that's where true peace is. We want the peace that passes all understanding that Paul talks about in Philippians 4. It's by being in that kingdom, not operating the kingdoms of men. They're going to do nothing for us. And while we sometimes maybe suffer, or we imagine we're going to suffer, or we see people suffering because of the kingdoms of men, we have this hope that in the midst of this severity, which is what we see toward the end of chapter 7, at the very end of that, in verse 26 to 27, there's victory. That God always wins. And every single one of us can choose to be on God's side as we walk through life. Can we help you do that this morning? Maybe you need to give your life to Jesus Christ. Submit your will to his will as king. And allow him to begin ruling over you and the things that you do. That's what Psalm 2 would tell you to do. And maybe you've done that, but you realize you're not living according to the king's edict. You're not doing the things that he said. You recognize in your life, as all of us, I think, do at some point, that maybe things are just not right. We're not doing what we need to do, and it's time to change. And maybe you need to come and tell everybody that. That maybe you just need to go and pray to God and begin to restructure the way that you do life. But remember the lesson. Remember what Daniel 7 tells us. Don't trust in the kingdoms of men. Trust in the Ancient of Days, and the Son of Man, and the kingdom that is victorious for all of us. Can we help this morning? Why don't you come now as we stand and be singing?